Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
The curtain of night is drawn back. The telescopes are trained. The domes are open. The audience is set. Now, step into the event horizon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the event horizon here on astronomy.fm. That means this is another Friday night, and this one happens to be September the 29th, 2017, also known universally as Saturday morning, September the 30th, 2017. Now, our local time right now would be 9:01 in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. Universal time, 1 o'clock in the morning-ish, something like that.
1:01 and 18 seconds.
And there you go. My name is Marty Coons with my co-host. What's your name, Nick?
Oh, I'm having headset trouble.
Okay, so Nick's having a little headset trouble, so he'll be here with us as soon as possible. In the meantime, I'd like to welcome everybody in our chat room right now and invite anyone listening in to come on over and join us in our chat room. You can get there going to the website at astronomy.fm, where you'll see, click where it says radio chat, or just type in astronomy.fm with a / and the word chat. Either way, we'll get you to the login page. Type in a name that you want us to refer you to, and then hit login. You'll be in our chat room, which is always the best thing to get into during a live presentation like right now. And that's where most people show up. But there are people that come in on the chat rooms at any time you want to. So if you come on in and hang around for a little bit, and then maybe somebody else will come on in, you can chat with other people too while they're listening to usually one of the repeats. So right now we're live, and we'll be live for the next hour, and we will repeat this program with other programs every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So I want to say hi to me and Glenn in chat so far, with and Nick's in the chat room, Aqua for You, Cassie, and Black Projects in our chat. Let's see. All right, so we're getting some quirky sound tonight. My mic sounds like it's too treble-ishly. Maybe I need to talk in more bass tones. Does that sound better? Well, hopefully we'll get our sound all straightened out. I feel like that one. All right, let's see where we want to. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll start out in the usual place I usually start out with, and that, of course, is talking about the sun, especially when there's something to talk about. Yes, there are sunspots on the sun. There are 3 sunspots on the sun. One's pretty small, about the size of the Earth, and starting to rotate away. One a little bit bigger than that, and one even about 2 to 3 times the size of the Earth itself. So we got some nice sunspots out there. A little bit of solar activity, not too much, but definitely enough to at least focus your telescopes on. Yeah, solar winds are definitely up because of a coronal hole in the sun. So wind speeds are 550 kilometers per second. That's reasonably fast. Density pretty low, though, only 1.62 protons per cubic centimeter. So that has the that does mean that there are some auroral activities around the pole. So if you live at high latitudes, you got pretty decent chance of seeing some auroral activity coming from the sun.
No, Glenn, the Earth will not kill. The sun will not kill the Earth yet, not for many million years to go.
Well, I hear you now, Nick.
Yeah, I've switched to my mobile phone, and I'm using Skype that way. My headset, it is kaput. It is a technique, as Mr. Harper would say.
I've had that, too. I've had it where I stepped on the cord and yanked it sideways. And so, yeah.
No, it's not its usual thing. It's there's a break in the cable somewhere. Well, there's multiple breaks in the cable now.
Mm-hmm.
So guess what? It's going in the bin. I will go and get another one next week.
There you go. I've had to, I've got one old headset that only one earpiece actually works. So I have to kind of flip my microphone around backwards to get to work. It's a hassle. Well, that's why I got a new one.
I've got another headset here, but for some reason, Windows 10 won't pick it up, and certainly Skype doesn't, which is a little bit concerning. It's a Plantronics job, and it's not a system. They're normally quite good pieces of kit, too.
Yeah, that's what I've got right now, actually, Plantronics. Works fine.
But,
all right, at least you're with us. That's the main thing.
Yep.
Say hi, Nick.
Hello, everybody. You couldn't get rid of me. Hi, hi. It's a bit Tony. Yes, it will be Glenn, because I'm on my mobile phone. Starstorm is with us, and she's sticking her tongue out at me. Yeah, she's taking its karma.
We're going to get to this before it totally disappears. Some questions in the chat room by a person named Marty. This was about 5 hours ago. So sorry we can't get to all your questions. I see there was an Alex in the chat about that time, too, or even earlier. I wish we could have somebody in the chat room all the time answering your questions. But at least we'll try to get to them now during this program. All right, there's like five questions here, so let's going to go with it. I'll read one at a time, and we'll see if we can figure out an answer to these questions. All right, did you read them, Nick, by any chance?
I've had a quick scan of them. I thought it was you, actually.
Going back in chat room to 14 hours, 59 minutes. So let's say 15-hour time mark. All right, here's the first question. If you weigh 100 pounds on the Earth and go to a planet that is twice the mass of the Earth and twice the size of the Earth, what is your new weight on that planet? What do you think about that?
Well, if it's double the mass of the Earth, so the gravity should be at least doubled, I would have thought.
Well, yes, however, though, you're twice as far away. Because they said the size of the planet would be twice as big.
Yes, the thing is, the planet, the more heavier you are. Look at Jupiter. Massive planet. And the gravity is crushing for us.
Right, but it's also a matter of density versus the distance to the center, just to the surface, for instance. So, if on the Earth, if you're twice as far away from the Earth, you weigh one quarter of your weight. So, if you have twice the mass, a planet with twice the mass, but it's twice as big, then at 100 pounds, you should. I think you would still weigh, would you weigh, let's see, you'd have to be twice, you'd weigh one quarter of the weight. So you would weigh 75 pounds, I believe. Or is it 25 pounds?
Twice the weight. But we don't know how fast the planet is spinning. That's the only thing.
That doesn't make a difference as far as your weight goes. It's general. They're generally negligible for that. So let's say that, twice the mass, but twice the distance. At twice the distance, you would weigh one quarter of your weight. So if it was one Earth mass, but it's twice the mass, so I'd say the answer to that one might be 50 pounds. Doubling, so you get twice the mass, I'm thinking. So that would put you at 200 pounds, and a quarter of that at twice the distance would put you at 50 pounds. That's my guess.
Well, yeah, because as I say, the thing that's missing from the equation is how fast is the said planet spinning. We know
that's generally negligible. You're not going to have a planet that's really going to affect your weight without blowing off a piece of the planet itself. So forget the spin of the planet. Just go with the mass and the size.
The thing is, though, when you go in a centrifugation, it spins you fast. The faster you get, the more gravity is applied to your body. Same with an aircraft in a climb at high speed. Now, I know for a fact that if I strap myself into an RAF tornado or a typhoon, and I go to afterburner and go straight up, I am going to be taking at least 4 or 5, maybe 6 Gs or more.
Right.
So, thing is, you can't, unless we know how fast the planet is rotating, we can't say that. We can't generalize.
All right, Nick. Let's say you weigh 100 pounds and you're standing at the North Pole of the Earth. Okay. Now, your spin is zero. Now you walk down to the equator. Now you're spinning at 1,000 miles an hour. How much less would you think you'd weigh?
But the thing is, the moon, we know what the lunar gravity is, and we know how light astronauts are on the moon, because they can moon bounce. They can just jump and go quite a distance.
Right, so, because it has 1/6 the mass of the Earth.
So basically, we need to know what the mass of the planet is, and
He's got that. It's twice the mass of the Earth.
Twice the mass of the Earth?
Yes.
So the more... To be honest, I would have thought you were going to get heavier. It's twice the mass of the Earth.
Right, but it's also based on distance from the surface. So if your planet is... he's saying it is twice the size. I will say that is actually twice the diameter, which puts it at really four times the size. So there's some variables on there. And what does he mean by twice the size?
Yeah. Is this a super Earth we're talking about?
Well, they're just a hypothetical planets he's got here. So if you're twice the size of the Earth, okay, let's just say that's basically twice the diameter. So that you would actually weigh less because you're farther away.
And
the planet density would be also half that of Earth, too.
Well, we know Saturn floats in the bathtub.
All right, here's the next question. If you weigh 100 pounds on Earth and go to a planet that is four times the mass of the Earth and the same times and the same size as the Earth, what is your new weight on that planet? Well, that one's pretty easy. You know what it is?
Perfect, Marty.
It is 400 pounds. So if you have, yes, if it's the same size planet, but four times the mass, you would weigh four times your weight. In this case, it's 100 pounds. So that means you would weigh 400 pounds on that one. All right, let's go to the next one. If you weigh 100 pounds on the Earth and you go to a planet that is 100 times the mass of the Earth and 10 times the size of the Earth, what would be your weight?
8 times planet. The mass of the Earth.
100 times the mass of the Earth, 10 times the size of the Earth.
In that case, I think I'm going to say pour me a drink and make it a hurricane. I ain't going to like it. Sorry, Martin.
Well,
there's a lot of variables missing from these questions.
That's pretty much all you really need. Questions like this is basically should be basically straight mass. It's math. I mean, math.
Math. Do you have a mast in your garden, Marty?
Pardon?
Do you have a mast in your garden? I have one on your ship on Wednesday night.
Glenn says, who came up with these questions? I don't know. It's just somebody named Marty that came up into the chat room about 5-6 hours ago and put these questions in there. It was not me, by the way. So. And a few more questions like that, too. I'm going to have to go through this list and see if I can double-check my answers for some of these. I think I got them kind of right, but the numbers are getting up there. Okay, let's see. If you weigh 100 pounds of Earth, go to a planet that is half the mass of the Earth and half the size of the Earth. What is your weight on that planet? Half the mass, half the size. Well, I think it might still be 100 pounds, but I'd have to check. If you weigh 100 pounds on Earth and go to a planet that is four times the mass of the Earth, you have the same weight. No, let's see. If you weigh 100 pounds on Earth and go to a planet that is four times the mass of the Earth, if it's the same size as the Earth, you would have, you'd weigh 400 pounds. I don't know if these are supposed to be answers to the questions or.
I don't know.
I didn't read it. I started reading them, but I didn't go all the way through.
Here's a question for you, Marty.
Alrighty.
Okay, and if you're as old as me and from the UK, you're probably going to get the joke. How do you turn science fiction into science fact?
I think is that the same thing as what's the difference between astrology and astronomy?
No. Okay. I think this was happened a couple of days ago. Musk? Elon Musk. Gave a talk. He gave his yearly talk to the astro space travel community. And what did he say that set off science fiction fans pretty much all around the world who are probably in the age range of about 55 to 65 years old? He, 30 minutes into his speech, he made a comment that sent a whole bunch of us, I suppose you could call it squealing with delight. Elon Musk is obviously talking about his plans for space travel to go to the moon, etc. And he mentioned something from a very well-known science fiction TV series. In fact, at that particular point when I was watching it, I actually went, wicked, did a Ron Weasley, and had to go then and PM the son of the creator of the show Space 1999. Why? Because in 30 minutes into his talk, he has announced that he wishes to build Moon Base Alpha. Okay, yeah. Now this is about 43 minutes long, and it's about just after the 30-minute mark, he actually says the immortal phrase, I am going to build Moon Base Alpha, or a lunar base. Well, I guess he's been on the same page as a whole bunch of us for a very long time. In fact, it was a case of, it was, well, we can't believe our luck. So I did actually PM Jamie Anderson, the son of Jerry Anderson, who created not only Space 1999, but UFO as well, which was his predecessor. And of course, UFO had a moon base. So it is kind of really, really nice to see something we've always really wanted as fact maybe about to happen. He was also talking about his latest design. He is building a rocket that's going to be reusable. It's going to have a module. And it is, the best thing about it is it's going to have a delta wing. Why? Because he wanted to be able to not only land on the moon, land on Mars, but be reusable from the Earth. He's talking a rocket that will put in the cost stakes, but heavy lift into being as cheap as chips. So yes, I was really, really thrilled to hear that speech at SpaceX 2017. The rocket is actually slightly taller than the Saturn V. It has four of his Raptor engines, and of course it has two other central engines with a much better gimbal capability for maneuvering. The other really nice innovation he's bringing in is in-flight refueling. So you would not only have a manned version, you have an unmanned version. The two vessels meet in space, they dock, and they use...
It looks like the Anastasia.
Thank you, Bartholomew. It looks like Dan, there's Anastasia. And it actually uses the exhaust bells to help refuel the manned or other cargo drone. What's the idea? Well, he says it's the Earth to the moon, landing and then coming back, refueling in orbit before doing anything else. So he's envisioning a fleet of these rockets, these super duper Falcons, where you can actually send man on a trip to Mars, come back and not have to worry about meeting stuff there, because it's either going to be staged and you won't even have to make fuel on the moon or on Mars, because you're going to have everything ready. Now, it is a long speech, and it is fun And to me, it really does speak that we're going to get there. We are finally, we finally have people, admittedly in private business, who have the vision to want to do this. He wants to go to Mars. He wants to provide a spacecraft that will do everything. He says, yeah, I'm going to keep the Falcon 9. I'm going to keep the Falcon X. Because he says it's going to take a while for the guys who pay to use 9 and X to get happy with the new rocket. So, of course, he's going to build up a stockpile of 9s and X's for the ISS, for Dragon, and for satellite launches. And he was asked very bluntly at one point about his plans to finance it. He says it's going to be self-financing because, let's face it, I'm in the satellite launch business. I'm in the ISS supply business. The ISS is going great guns. It isn't going to demise anytime soon unless something really cataclysmic happens, like some idiot fills the orbit with space shrapnel from a satellite being killed. Yes, shades of gravity there, Glenn, since it was being mentioned earlier. So, you know what? We're actually going to get somewhere. I think this guy can do it. Because at the end of the day, he networks. He knows Steve Bezos. He knows everybody in the business. He started with his original Falcon rocket. Nobody wanted to work for him. And that was perhaps the biggest thing. He had to go from start to having a viable rocket. It took 4 launches to get a viable rocket. But the 4th time was the charm, and he did it. So now, of course, the rest is history. He's pioneering the use of reusable spacecraft. The first stage booster is currently being reused. He's looking to reuse more and more of the spacecraft as time goes on. This guy is really rocking the business. And yeah,
if you want to get fancy, you don't need to take the Delta wings all the way to the moon. You could basically leave the wings in orbit.
Well, yeah, they toyed with that idea, from what I understand. But they figured it's easier just to build the whole thing as one unit.
Easier to build, but you're also taking extra weight, which costs extra fuel. So
they're refueling in orbit, Marty. They're not having to carry the fuel there and back. They have tankers waiting. They're just the unmanned version.
In orbit? So you could still leave your wings in orbit, and the fuel will get you farther to the moon, and then come back and pick your wings up for landing again.
Well, I think that's one of the things. Yeah, there's a note in our control room. Elon Musk also indicated the corporate slogan will be Thunderbirds are go. Mm-hmm. You got to love the guy. Gerry Anderson is probably putting a very big smile on his face wherever he is, and he's probably very happy. So is probably Jamie, because this guy is making their dreams come true. And to be honest, if he can rock Moonbase Alpha into existence, and what else can't he do? He sees it as a way to hop and do things. NASA and Russia and Roscoe are planning a joint venture space station in lunar orbit. Things are getting interesting again. Thank you, Starstorm. She's putting the links into NASA TV and to SpaceX channel in.
In fact, you could basically launch. You could have a couple different systems if you're going to do all that in orbit, anyways. You could just do a transfer in orbit too. You could transfer your cargo and your crew in orbit. So basically, you've got the lift vehicle and with the wings. But basically, it's more of a reentry vehicle with wings. You could leave that. You go up and down with that, and then just basically transfer everything to the translunar rocket. So you go, you know, from the Earth to the Moon in a different type of rocket, basically, kind of like a cargo crate. You know, basically transfer the whole thing into another rocket, take that to the Moon and back, and then go back into orbit again. and get back into the landing device, which doesn't even have to have cargo capability. You know, it could be much smaller getting back from orbit down to the Earth with a much smaller vehicle, just like the old capsules.
Well, yeah, we have that technology will be complementing it. We're going to have Orion, we're going to have Dream Chaser. Everybody is working on their own version of either from Earth to orbit or from orbit back to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that what Musk is wanting to do is to have one vehicle that does everything, so that at the end of the day, he has an extreme heavy lift vehicle that can actually just do everything. It can go to Mars, it can go to the moon. Who knows how far it can actually go? Maybe using the tanker idea, he could actually send missions out. They could be sending missions out as far as the asteroid belt and beyond. Yes, mm-hmm. the thing is, we're lucky that we have the level of competition. It is competition. Everybody's vying for the same business. And the whole thing that's going to turn out is that at the end of the day, because everybody is trying their best to provide a system,
mm-hmm.
Yes, eventually the best one will win. And I think having one vehicle that can go from light, that can actually do everything. He's even talking about using the drone version, for collecting space debris from the Clark Belt. That was one of the things he did bring up in this speech this year,
mm-hmm.
Clearing the Clark Belt of debris and eventually being able to perhaps put satellites there, and once they're dead, scrap them and bring them home. Mm-hmm. They can be then dismantled and properly dealt with. Now, maybe that would be something that would devolve eventually to a lunar facility or a space station. But the nice idea is he's got the vision, and he's thinking about problems that we have. We have boosters up there. We have dead satellites that are doing nothing, just taking space. They're becoming a pest, and they become eventually a threat. And that threat will be a big issue for space traveling, not only just tourists, but for scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he's the vehicle he's proposing to be the do-it-all, it's going to have a 40-compartment area for humans. It's going to have a solar shelter for solar storms, and it's going to be carrying a very large tonnage of fuel. So, with this idea of refueling in space, by simply pointing the fuel-laden vehicle in one direction and allowing the motion of the vehicle to prime and pump everything into the vehicle that needs it. That's a great idea. No one's ever tried it. And he's the first to admit it. He says the first thing they have to do is work on a robotic unmanned docking system.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is if you're sending... Yeah, and I'm being told I've got to check there's links in the room. Yes, we have also the ESA link, and there's a link to about the Russian Moon Joint Lunar Space Station.
Chat box?
Yeah.
Well, I think unmanned docking is preferable, actually, because the Russians tried manual docking, and they crashed a supply vehicle into the Mir space station by trying to do it, you know, visually. It's not a good idea, so remote generally works better anyway.
Hey, Sonic, welcome to chat. So I better get that in, because that's what Starstorm was trying to tell me.
Richie, too.
Yeah. But as I say, the greatest thing is people are finally committing to us being a spacefaring species.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, we hopefully will not end up the way the dinosaurs did.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had a couple hundred million years to see if we can out-survive them.
Yeah. The thing is, we have a better chance because they were taken out by, a comet or an asteroid. A very big chunk of rock, either way, came in. We know it's there because of the Chicxulub crater and the KT boundary of Iridium. We have a chance now as a spacefaring species to beat this, we can do one of two things. We can either actively chase and nudge NEOs or anything else that's potentially going to do us harm, or we can find other ways to do it that don't require the Bruce Willis approach, if you like. Turning it into shrapnel, which would probably be just as worse, if not even more dodgier for the Earth, a whole bunch of huge shards raining down on us. So, hey, this guy, he's got the desire, he is pushing for it, and he's obviously, his shareholders must be behind him to let him do it. And obviously they like the idea of having an extreme heavy lift vehicle that can actually eventually is supposed to be able to outlift a Saturn V, where this vehicle does everything. They could actually load up four or five heavy satellites and go at once. That in itself, having one launch for five satellites, would be a game changer, because it means
it saves time,
it saves money
and resources.
So this is going
to
be
one rocket.
Exactly, thank you, Starstorm. So hey, I really appreciate what this guy said. I want Moonbase Alpha. I would like to think maybe by the time I'm in my 90s or 100s, I can actually go to the moon and maybe visit Tranquility Base as a tourist. I would love that.
Get a t-shirt that says, I walked on the moon.
Yep.
And truly did the moonwalk.
Hey, this proves it's live, folks. We actually have Starstorm joining in yet again. She's enjoying herself.
Mm-hmm. I still need to look up the lift versus, you know, fuel capacity to cargo capacity of rockets. They've got to be all fairly close. If you build a heavy lift vehicle, it's still going to use, to lift more weight, it's still going to use that much more fuel to do the same thing. So just because if you strap five Saturn V's together, you're going to get the lift of, you know, five cargo pieces, but you're using five times as much fuel. So I'm not so sure there's all that trade-off, because the efficiency in rocket engines is not dramatic.
Who knows, maybe this will provide medical advances.
Well, as I say, yeah, maybe this will even provide medical advances. Now, our program director is also putting a comment. You have to manufacture the fuel in space or space materials. That's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
Use the asteroids and comets that come our way.
Well, let's not get rid of the comets, because they're too beautiful.
Okay, well, the asteroids at least.
Yep, let's go to the asteroid belt. Let's mine the asteroid belt.
Yeah, or probably my first indication would probably be more like a comet. So if you can get a comet of water and split up the hydrogen and oxygen from the water, then basically you'll burn them back in as rocket fuel, and you could do that too. In fact, basically all you have to do is build a processing unit on the comet itself, maybe seal it over, and burn it up as you're traveling with it.
Yeah, as I say,
so you don't have to even get the fuel from the comet. Basically, you build the rocket as part of the comet.
Now, I'm just trying to see if there's anything here. Mostly just seeing launches for Falcon 9s and stuff.
But then again, it's Wikipedia.
And then maybe what would be interesting, too, is if we could get a probe deep into a comet, how far in could it go to stop cosmic rays? You might have a good chance of doing that, too. So, yeah, basically you we need to experiment on boring into a comet and putting a cosmic ray detectors in there and find out if you can get in at a reasonable distance or how far and get rid of that cosmic radiation issue. So that might be a good piece of the answers, part of the puzzle there.
See, now I'm going to say this right now because I just remind about it. Now tonight, after the Event Horizon, is the 250th episode of Talking Space. That's always worth a listen to.
And, of course, we do repeat this program and that program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So keep listening in after we're done with the Event Horizon program. We still got another half hour of that. Keep listening in for more programming that we will repeat every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. More stuff to listen to. We're about halfway through our program right now. You are listening to the Event Horizon here on astronomy.fm radio. It is September the 29th, 2017, at about 9:35 in the evening here. For those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, universal time, that would put it at 1:35 in the morning, September the 30th, Saturday morning, 2017. So, glad you're all listening in. Of course, a reminder to come on over to our chat room if you have questions for us. It's easy to get here. Go to the homepage, look where it says radio chat, or type in astronomy.fm/chat. Either way, we'll get you to the login page. Come on over and join us and let us know if you're here the first time, where you're listening in from, just generally. Just kind of fun to know where our audience is at. We got people from the UK, South America, and all over the place, and of course the US.
Now, I just put a picture into chat, a link into chat, of this is the proposed spacecraft. This is the Anastasia he wants to design and build. So that gives you an idea of what they expect it to look like.
Okay.
And Optronics is saying he took apart that 20x20 binocular. Optronics, how did that go? What was it? How was the experience like?
Was the what? His experience on what was that you said?
He took apart a 20x80 binocular.
Ah. Yeah, I've taken a few things like binoculars apart before, too, and some of it's not too bad. A lot of times the front lenses will pop right out. Sometimes there is an eccentric ring around the lenses to help you adjust them a little bit. So sometimes you have to take some screws out. Sometimes they'll just untwist. The tricky part is when you get in around the prism area. Sometimes that stuff's glued in. Once you get it apart, you generally can't get them back in the proper position anymore. So you might end up with like a couple of monoculars instead of a pair of binoculars again, because they have to be really lined up. Otherwise, you get a double vision effect if you don't get all your optics in properly. I've taken several binoculars apart. It's fun to do. You make a couple of 80 millimeter telescopes too, the same way, taking 20x80 binoculars apart. Yeah, done stuff like that. Don't forget the parts. Don't let the parts fall out though. Unscrew something and have lenses fall down. That's a little bit of an issue.
Ah, here we go. This was the image I was looking for. Hi, Astro John. Welcome to chat. Okay, now, I'm just going to check that works. Yes, it does. This gives you an idea of the rockets he's talking about. This is the Falcon XX. So at one end, you've got the Saturn V. You've got the Falcon 9, the Falcon 9 Heavy, the Falcon X, Falcon X Heavy, and then the Falcon XX. Now, mate it with this is the XX that will get the capsule I put into chat a few moments ago as the exploration module. You can also get, he's planning a purely unmanned version for satellite launches, as I said, for cleaning up the Clark belt. And I think this guy could do it. And you know what? I suspect, if anything, he will probably get together with even his competitors purely to do something that is going to be fairly spectacular. Now, the way he explained it, and I'm sure you'll probably all get it when you watch the video, is the fact that normally, as you go up in the size of the rocket, the more expense. And the idea is with the XX, because he's going to make it as much of the rocket reusable as he has with his Falcon 9, but instead of being at the high end of expense, it's going to drop right down to the low end of expense. Because his theory is the more bits of a spacecraft you really reuse and you recycle for other launches, the cheaper the technology becomes. So it's a very interesting concept. And this guy wants to go to Mars, he wants to go to all these places. And you know what? If it's going to take a joint NASA, SpaceX, Blue Yonder get-to-get mesh of technology and money. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with this because the biggest complaint is, oh, the government is spending too much money on NASA. Well, given how much of our tax money actually goes on NASA, it's pennies in reality. It's nothing compared to the other federal expenditure. So if NASA can get together with SpaceX, with Blue Yonder, if they can sit down with Elron and with Steve Bezos and say, this is where we're going to go, and we're going to all do this together, I totally approve. And then they can bring in the European Space Agency, they can bring in Roscosmos. I'm pretty sure JAXA at some point would love to get into the job of exploring space with astronauts and being able to take part in missions. Yes, everybody has sent team members up to the ISS. Some of them have stayed long, some of them are in short missions, some of them are space tourists. But you know what? This guy is really, really serious. And I think at the end of the day, he may actually sit down around the table with Bezos, with NASA, with the European Space Agency, with everybody, and say, let's get together, let's pool our resources, and let's do it. Let's not give up on the dream, a dream that three great guys died to make happen. So that's just my thing. Okay, yeah, I know. I'm going to get yelled at. I'm on a soapbox. But you know what? I sat there. I actually watched this video before work. And I was so, so impressed that he really wants to do it and that he has the drive. And I think by getting together and sitting down with everybody, we will do it. I could see us having a united federation of planets someday in the far future. It will be brilliant. Even a united solar system would be great. It's a start. And you know what? Once we have a dependable, reusable way to get to the moon, we could put our observatories up there. Hey, could you imagine? Hey, I'm logging into the telescope on Mare Imbrium, or the Sea of Crises. Wouldn't that be excellent?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe get a ship called the Orville.
Oh God, we have an Orville fan here too as well.
Hey, you're the one who.
Yes, I know. It's my fault. I started. I was watching it. Yes, the ISS is a start, Glenn. But you know what? It's the fact that it's still there. It's still going on. Eventually, it's going to go into high Earth orbit. That will be even better. So yes, we really do need these projects from people like SpaceX, from Blue Yonder, to happen. Because that way we can service it, we can maintain it. And, you know, who knows, with this new idea from SpaceX, maybe we can build a bigger, better Hubble. Because he's talking about that the remote
fix
drone
the
version.
Mars rovers!
Yeah, I'm sure you heard that. Fix the Mars rovers. But you know what?
Because they're still useful.
We need to be able to put bigger, better versions of instruments like Hubble.
Get a Thunderbird 3. a whole line of Thunderbirds.
Okay. I think you can all gather that Starstorm is very enthusiastic about space travel, and she really wants it too. Hey, I would love to see my grandkids on the moon or on Mars. You want to go do the sun mask before I get going again?
You plan on not liking them, huh?
Pardon?
I said you plan on not liking your grandkids.
Oh, I want to go visit them on Mars or the Moon.
Okay.
I want to be the tourist. Where else can you go? I've been everywhere else in the world.
That's right. South Pole?
No, I haven't been to the South Pole yet.
Better get to the North Pole before it melts.
The Enterprise!
It'll still be there, I think, in a few years' time. Just. Anyway, Marty, the sun.
The sun. I did talk a little bit about the sun already.
Oh, you did? Okay. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. But we do have sort of a new comet coming in, but really far away. It's called C2017 K2. It's a comet coming from the Oort cloud. It's still really far away. I think this is one of the farthest active comets that Hubble Space Telescope has actually been able to image. Now, it's so far out, it's actually going to take another couple of years before it actually gets here. Kind of reminds me of another one. It does have a bit of a coma, and that's always a bit encouraging for a potentially, you know, good comet. However, the way comets behave, you just don't know. So just because it's got a little bit of a coma right now, and it's like out around Saturn, Uranus, something like that.
It's about 1.5 billion miles away.
Yeah, I think between Saturn and Uranus. So with a coma, doesn't mean that it's going to retain that coma all the way in and become spectacular. Now, the one that did that before, I think was it Hayakutake or the other one? What was it? Two comet, Hayakutake and the other one that was Hale-Bopp. Yeah, I think it was Hale-Bopp. They kind of did the same thing. I did see Hale-Bopp at least a year out, a little closer than this one, but and it of course it did live up to its expectations. When it had a coma far out, it kept the coma even bigger when it got in.
Right.
So next one coming, it's not even in the comet list right now, so basically it's just you'd have to go look it up on Wikipedia or the Hubble Space Telescope.
I got news. Some of us on certain groups are already talking about it. Mm-hmm. Now, this is what gets a lot of people. The sunlight is merely 1/225 its brightness as seen from Earth. The temperatures correspondingly are at a whopping -440 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, even at such bone-chilling temperatures, the ice is on the surface, the oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and carbon monoxide are already beginning to sublimate and shed as dust. Now, you can imagine this material is going to balloon, this balloons into a vast 80,000-mile-wide halo of dust, which is the coma. That's enveloping the solid nucleus.
Which is really not very big, because if you remember Comet Holmes, that actually had a coma of about 1 million miles. So this is still well short of that. So 80,000, not too bad. But is it still got plenty of fuzzy stuff that's going to ablate off it? Or by the time in a couple of years it takes to actually get here, all that stuff might be ablated off and we end up with just kind of a hard surface that doesn't shoot anything else off of it. So hard to say. It's not going to get real close.
We should know in 2022.
Yep, 2022. So we got quite a few years. That's like 4 or 5 years now. Well, let's make it 4 years. So I think Hale-Bopp was spotted about 2 years out. So this is twice as far as that ish or so. We'll see what happens. You cannot predict what's going to happen with comets. It's not going to get real close to the sun. It's only going to get about 1.5 astronomical units, so about the orbital distance of Mars. But I have no information on how close it's going to get to the Earth. So it could be on the opposite side of the sun during its close approach. Could be on the Earth side of the sun. Could be, which has advantages and disadvantages. We might be able to see it really closest to us, but we also might have the tail pointing directly away from us. So basically it does look like a coma instead of that spectacular comet tail that we really like to see with most comets. So who knows?
Agreed. Now the thing is, Aqua for you is saying you can predict, but you were wrong. Sometimes you are, sometimes you're not. Now, the thing is, that is why most of us who are comet hounds, I suppose you could say, really like to keep our mouths shut on whether it's going to be naked eye or not, because we just don't know. You can have a very bright comet that's coming in, and suddenly it can fizzle.
Now, you got to read all of Aquafew's statement. He says, you can predict what will happen with a comet, but you'll be wrong.
I don't know. If it was Brian Marsden making the predictions, or maybe Gene Shoemaker or David Levy, I would listen. Those guys really know their stuff. So does Alan Hale.
As many comets as I have seen, they're not predictable as far as how much they're going to be in outburst.
That's why I never predict an outburst.
That's what I'm talking about. You can you can calculate its position and its orbit, things like that. I haven't seen any data on it yet. But you can calculate that. But you can't predict how much it's going to outgas. And a few other parameters, too.
Okay, so the sky this week. Let's go there, shall we, Marty?
Oh, let's go on. Let's go to the sky. You go to your list, and I'll look at the star chart at the same time, and
yeah,
we'll see where we go.
Okay, so this is the sky at a glance, September 29th, October 7th. So as the stars come out in late twilight, look above the moon for Altair. Now the moon is getting is waxing gibbous at the moment. It's a getting close to, I would say, it's pretty much first quarter, really. Now, once the sky is dark, left of Altair is the look for dim little Delphinus, the dolphin about a fist at arm's length from it. A little less far straight above Altair is the smaller, dimmer constellation Sagitta, the arrow. Binoculars will help. On Saturday, September the 30th, Arcturus is shining in the west these evenings and sinking as twilight fades away. Equally bright Capella is rising lower in the northeast. That depends on your latitude. The further north you are, the higher it will be. They're both magnitude zero, as bright as Vega overhead. By mid-evening, Arcturus and Capella shine at identical heights. When exactly this will happen? Well, that does depend on your latitude and longitude. When it happens, turn around and look low in the south-southwest, well to the lower left of the moon tonight, and there you'll see, there you'll find first magnitude Fomalhaut at the same height too. If you're at latitude 40 degrees north, seen from south of that latitude, Fomalhaut will be higher than Capella and Arcturus. Seen from the north of there, it will be lower. On Sunday the 1st of October, the starry W of Cassiopeia stands high in the northeast after dark. The right-hand side of the W, the brightest side, is tilted up. Now look along the second segment of the W, counting down from the top. It's not quite horizontal. Notice the dim naked eye star partway along the segment. That's Eta Cassiopeiae, magnitude 3.4. It's a sun-like star. It's about 19 light years away with an orange dwarf companion. Aren't we lucky it's not ours? Okay, it's a lovely binary pair in a telescope with an easy separation of 20 arc seconds. Left of Eta Cass along the segment is the fainter, most wider pair, Upsilon and Upsilon 1 Epsilon 2 Cassiopeiae, separation 0.3 degrees. That's 1,200 arc seconds. This pair consists of two orange giants, and they're unrelated to each other. They're 200 and 400 light years from us. It's a line of sight effect. Okay, so Monday the 2nd. After dark, look low in above the northeast horizon, far below Cassiopeia, but bright Capella on the right. How high you find it, again, depends on your latitude. The further north, the higher it is. By Tuesday, Vega is the brightest star very high in the west at nightfall. Arcturus, equally bright, is getting low in the west-northwest. The brightest star in the vast expanse between them, about a third of the way from Arcturus up towards Vega, is Apocella, magnitude 2.2, the crown jewel of Corona Borealis. This is a 17-day eclipse in binary, but its brightness dips are too slight for the eye to see reliably. Okay, Wednesday, October 4th, Venus and Mars are in conjunction at early dawn tomorrow, forming a tight pair. There are about a quarter of a degree apart during dawn for the Americas. Look low in the east. Binoculars or a low-power telescope will help separate the dazzle of Venus from the dimmer lights of Mars, magnitude 1.8, and nearby Cygna Leonis, even fainter at magnitude 4.0, not shown on the maps. By Thursday, October the 5th, full moon, and that's exactly full at 2:40 p.m. EDT. The moon rises due east around sunset. After dark, as the moon gains height, look for the great square of Pegasus balancing on one corner. And by Friday, October the 16th, the moon is just past full. It rises in the east in late twilight. As night arrives, look for the two brightest stars of Aries to the moon's upper left by about a fist and a half at arm's length. The stars are 4 degrees apart, less than half a fist, and line up almost horizontally. Can you see that the brighter one, Hemel, on the left, has an orange tint? And, of course, by Saturday, the great square of Pegasus, balances on its corner high in the east at nightfall. For your location, when is it exactly balanced? That is when the square's top corner is exactly above its bottom corner. It'll be sometime after the end of twilight, depending on both your latitude and longitude. Try lining them up with the vertical edge of a building for improved position. And thank you very much, Sky and Telescope, for that very interesting blog.
Okay.
Arr.
That's another show. By the way, the moon is about 2 degrees north of the planet Pluto tonight, in case you were wondering about that. Saturn's still visible, but getting ready to set. Planet Uranus is north and slightly east of the bright star Fomalhaut. And recently risen is the planet Uranus. There was a comet, Assassin, is visible in our skies, so predicted to be, I haven't seen it, so I'm just going to go with predictions to be about ninth magnitude-ish or so. They're usually dimmer than that, but it is approximately between the Hyades and the Pleiades, and then a little bit farther north from there by a few degrees. So if you're getting out doing some observing tonight, Comet Assassin is just about risen right now, so be a few more hours before it gets into some nice dark skies where hopefully you are. The moon being about a little bit past first quarter, still got a chance for the moon to get out of the way as the comet rises higher and have a chance to go see it. So give that a shot. And of course, I want to give a shout out to all the people and the multiple clubs at the Astronomy at the Beach event this weekend here in Michigan. About 10 to 12 astronomy clubs get together, and each of them brings 10 to 12 telescopes out for the general public to do some stargazing that they're doing right now under partially clear skies. Anybody's listening from there? Hey, I hope everybody's doing good out there. I can't get out there this weekend. I'll be out of town tomorrow night.
Well, you know what the nice thing is? Winter is coming. We've got Orion in the sky. I was out at 6 o'clock this morning reading the rain gauge for Cocorus, and it was still dark enough to make out the belt with just my eyes. And you could also see the Sword of Orion and make out a fuzzy spot, which, of course, we all know is M42. But it's kind of nice because it's nice, nice, crisp mornings. And there are times I really wish I was able to go completely nocturnal and just spend the whole night out there and just enjoy it. But then again, I'd probably get bitten to death by the midges and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Some new data from an old probe, the Venus Express, European Space Agency's Venus Express, which has been gone for about a year and a half now, two years, something like that. They've collected some data together and found that they've found some unusual characteristics on the nighttime clouds of Venus, different from the daytime clouds on Venus. Let me pop that article into our chat room for that. Go read some further information on that. That probe is gone somewhere in 2015, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Had multiple missions extended, but finally probably, I think it ran out of attitude fuel, because they could still get a carrier signal from it, but no data transfer at all.
That's sad. See, maybe one of the things I would really like is perhaps some of these missions that have spent their fuel or their cryogenic gases could then be reactivated once we have a reliable way of safely capturing them.
Mm-hmm.
I would really like the rovers to be refurbished and kept going.
Mm-hmm.
But we shall soon find out how it goes. Mm-hmm. I think we have a bright future ahead, particularly with the fact people now care about and want to go places, even if we're tourists. Yes, Glenn's Spirit would be really, really great to have it refurbed, and Oppie too.
All right, everybody. Time for us to think about heading out of here. Thank everybody that's been in our chat room tonight. Really appreciate you being here. Can you get through?
Yeah.
Can you get through?
I'm getting through. Captain, this is the away team. The three to beam up to the Miranda. Captain 7, please just acknowledge and beam us out of here before it's too late.
Hey, thanks, everybody. Appreciate you all listening in. Don't forget, we're going to repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So keep listening in. And, of course, more programming coming up right after the Event Horizon here on Astronomy.fm Radio. 250th
episode of Talking Space, 5 minutes after EH.
Night, all.
Good night.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy. Around the world and across the known universe, this is Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
There I was, doing my thing. And all of a sudden, wham! Astronomy right between the eyes.